My podcasts often deal with distressing situations which are not suitable for children, and some adults for that matter. Some of what I discuss may trigger uncomfortable emotions. If that does occur, please reach out to Lifeline, Beyond Blue, or any other support service or person you feel comfortable with. It's also important to note that there's always two sides, sometimes more, to every story. My guests provide their recollection of an event or incident, sharing their thoughts and their emotions, but it's theirs and theirs alone. Not everyone will agree with them. I never want to tell any guest what to say or what not to say. So please try and keep that in mind. Today's podcast is my guest's version of events, and there'll always be others who see it differently. Hello, I'm Narelle Fraser. I was a cop with Victoria Police for 27 years, 15 of those as a detective, having dealt with all types of crime from a stolen bicycle to a stolen life. I witnessed the effect crime has on all those involved and became one of those victims myself in 2012 when I was diagnosed with PTSD. However, out of adversity comes other opportunities like this, my own podcast. I still pinch myself, but thanks for listening and coming with me as we explore the human side and impact of crime.
She had this knack of, if she told you the sky was red and you go, no, it's blue, she would convince you to the point where you go, why don't you go outside and double check that?
It's hard to understand or even contemplate that life could be any different than the life that we know and we grew up in. I never thought there were people who didn't have a house to live in, who didn't have a warm bed, who didn't have a dad, who would work 5 days a week and Saturday mornings and was home every night for dinner, which was always on the table, 6:30 on the dot. The only thing I worried about as a kid was getting my new dress dirty after Mum had told us not to play in the half-finished house down the road, or if Mum had overcooked the peas, as I remember Dad would complain if they weren't just right. It doesn't paint a good picture of my dad, but it was one of his few faults. And the fact that he couldn't get his homemade beer recipe right, which was of great frustration to him. But Mum was always there before school and after school, and she was home from her part-time job every single day for us. Just normal everyday stuff, or so I thought. My guest today couldn't have had a more different life. Her mum and dad's relationship was volatile. They argued and there was violence. And it was initiated by her mother, yes, her mum, every single time. And it came to light years later that her mum was actually a thief. Her mum stole money and deceived people. And for that, she spent a lot of time in and out of jail for her crimes. Elisa, my guest, remembers her parents separating when she was only little and with her mum moving constantly between states, staying anywhere they could, on friends' couches, in motels, refuges, and sometimes in their car. Elisa remembers receiving presents from the Selvos one Christmas and being left to her own devices much of the time, not knowing where her mum was or who she was with. She was cared for by her paternal and maternal aunts, and in between living with them, she was in foster care. Unlike our friend Scott from a couple of episodes ago and too many others, Elisa has fond memories of her foster parents, who she remains in contact with to this day, unlike her mum, who just abandoned her. Thanks for your time today, Elisa. And how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good, but that's actually a lie. I know you're not good. I know from some previous conversation we had this morning that you've been out, you've been having fun, and you're a little bit dusty.
Yes, that's fact. That is indeed fact.
So when are we going to learn?
look, I don't think there's much hope for me at this point. I'm nearly 35 and I have not learnt yet. So we'll just see how we go.
Oh, that's funny. Well, yeah, we'll keep your water levels up and this should take about an hour and then you can go and lay your head on that pillow. So let's get on with today. So when we spoke to organise today, I remember listening to you telling me what you were going to say and thinking that it being unimaginable for me and a lot of others out there that are listening to feel abandoned as a child. Can you tell me what it felt like for you?
You're not meant to. You're not meant to feel abandoned by either of your parents. I mean, they're the ones that brought you into this world. They're meant to protect you and they're meant to always be there. So to feel as if you're just a waste of time, it's something that you just cannot put into words. For a very long time, it was always why did you do this? Why me? What did I do wrong? You know, there were always unanswered questions, but, you know, and it took a very, very long time and a lot of growth to realize that it actually had nothing to do with me. It was not about me. And then a lot of work with my dad from his side, that it was never abandonment from him. So, yeah, it's very difficult to put into words, really. But my dad and I are good, very good. My anger with my dad did not last very long, to be honest. I'm a daddy's girl, a bit of a pushover. Can't be mad at him. But when I went into foster care, I was very angry because, I mean, I was only 10, for memory, at the time. And I just, you know, I was too young to understand the adult world and, you know, the whys and hows and all the rest of it. And to me at the time it was, oh, you can't be bothered, just like mum, can't be bothered with me, too hard basket. When it was really the complete opposite, but he made a lot of effort to make sure that he was always around in some way, shape or form, always on the other end of the phone if I needed him. You know, I knew where he worked down the road from my school. So if anything was ever wrong, there was always somewhere to run. But, you know, as the years progressed, it was a cruel to be kind exercise, I think. It was, I needed to know that you were going to be looked after and I needed to be able to provide in the best way that I could. And, you know, he worked shift work and he couldn't leave me on my own overnight while he's working two night shifts in a row. That just wasn't okay and it was never going to be okay. So, I mean, now we talk about it and I'm so grateful for what he did, because it really was putting me first. So, yeah, we're good. We talk all the time.
That's good. You said before that you felt when you were little that you were a waste of time, and you said that you used to think, what's wrong with me? At what age did you think like that?
I think it would have been probably 9 or 10 when, you know, my mum actually left the picture, really, because, you know, if you, even at that age, and I knew that things weren't right with her, I thought, well, there's clearly some issues here. Why can't you just be different? Why can't you just be better? Should I not be enough motivation for that? And it just wasn't. You know, everything else was a priority. She couldn't just be happy with the things that she had, always had to be more. And, you know, she's sick. She's a sick woman. And I can't change that. And I don't think she can either.
When you say your mum was a sick woman, what do you mean by sick?
Mentally ill. There was a lot of things happening with her. She was a compulsive liar to the highest degree. There's the belief, I mean, everybody seems to have a different story in the whole scenario. So there's a belief that there's multiple personality disorder, mild schizophrenia, God knows what else. She's just always been troubled, always.
You had quite a few involvements with police when you were young. Can you tell me about that?
So my police involvement obviously was regarding her and things that were going on with my parents, and she would instigate an argument and it would be Dad's fault. You know, it's always Dad's fault. There was intervention orders and all sorts of stuff from, you know, Mum against Dad, and you know, the poor bugger hadn't actually done anything to deserve it, but it was very much, you know, when it comes to domestic violence and intervention orders and things like that, it's always the man, you know. It's almost inconceivable to think that a woman could be at fault. So it was all about sort of, oh, you know, woe is me, protecting me, my husband this, blah, 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 blah. So I think it's long been always a predominantly male thing, that it's the perpetrator of domestic violence or violence in general. Oh, that woman, she was so manipulative. She would, I mean, if she had this knack of, if she told you the sky was red and you go, no, it's blue, she would convince you to the point where you go, shit, let me go outside and double check that. And she, I'm not even joking.
Yeah.
It's like she's the crazy one, yet she makes you feel like you are Jack's crackers. And she's just, I can't even put words into it. So there was one particular incident when I was with my dad, and she came to pick me up, and there was just an argument, and I don't even know what it was about, but I do know that a fly screen got broken, and then the police showed up, and the police officer at the time was quite abrupt. Mind you, I'm only a child, maybe 7, 6, 7, 8, I don't know. Anyway, I was young, and he was, you know, I didn't want to go with her. I wanted to stay with my dad. And I was told in no uncertain terms, you either get in the car with your mother and leave now, or I will take you to the police station or something along those lines. And I just thought, that guy's my dad. And she is losing her tiny mind. Like, you can see that she was just fired up and argumentative. And yet somehow you're trying to convince me to that she's the better option. Like, why can't I just stay with my dad? Why can't you tell her to go home? But in the car I went, and I was just really angry about it, because I just thought, hang on, that's my dad and I want to see him, and that's my mom and I should be able to see her too. And I don't know, it was very confusing. And that was probably the first of many times.
That's interesting you say that, because I've got a friend who was my boss when I was working in domestic violence and child abuse. And she says that often when you used to go to a domestic violence incident, or this is way back, you know, in the days that you're talking about, the kids weren't even considered. It wasn't a consideration to go and speak to the child.
No.
And say to the child, who do you want to go with and why, or who don't you want to go with and why, and just speak to the child about what was wrong, what frightened you, what made you feel good. It wasn't even a consideration, which is wrong, isn't it?
It really is, because the kids are the one that are stuck in the middle, and kids are very honest. They're very innocently honest. Some of the things that my kids come out with, I just think, I can't take you in public. That's disgraceful. You are so brutally honest and people will get offended. I mean, so I look at it very differently now, and I just shake my head sometimes and think, Jesus, I made that. What did I do? why do the police, social workers, et cetera, not sit with a child and say, what happened? What's your side of things? What did you see? How can we help you? What will make you feel safer? And it was not about that. It was absolutely not about it. It was mum and dad are fighting and mum's winning the fight. That's really what it came down to. And it was all about her manipulation. And it was just, I just don't understand it. I'll never understand it.
I think police are changing, and I think now that their feelings, their emotions, their thoughts are actually being considered. I'm not saying a lot, but it's certainly changing, because I think I've said before, and I don't know if you were brought up like this, but when we were kids, the saying was that children are to be seen and not heard.
And not heard. Yes.
You didn't contribute to a conversation, because you could only contribute when you were asked. And I'm not saying that was like it when I was at home, but that was how it was. But I hope now that it is changing. Well, I know it is, and that children are being spoken to and they are being asked. And from what you're saying, is that when you were a child, if somebody would have asked you, tell me what you're scared of or whatever, you would have told them.
Yeah, absolutely. Yep, absolutely. And I never once had a fear of my father. Never once. I mean, I wouldn't do the wrong thing, because my dad has an angry face. That's scary enough. But you know, I knew when I'd get in trouble and I'd be like, oh, how do I get him on my good side again? But, yeah, I was never in fear of him. I never feared for my life, never feared for my safety. I have always, every day of my life, felt safe and protected with him. But mum, there was a question mark.
Tell me about the time on the bus.
So we had moved to Queensland, and my mother and I and her partner at the time, who had no knowledge of her previous indiscretions. And anyway, so I didn't want to live in Queensland. I actually wanted to be back in Wodonga with my dad, and because, you know, I'd gone to school there and I had friends there and it was familiar. So in Queensland, not wanting to be, I didn't like the school. I'd do anything to get out of it, actually. And things obviously turned pear-shaped because, you know, mum was up to her old tricks again. And so we had to leave. So mum said, oh, you know, we're moving back to Melbourne. And I was, well, back to Wodonga, but we're going to Melbourne and we're going to stay with some family. And I thought, oh, this is excellent, can't wait. We're catching the bus, and I thought, oh, God, you know, it's a long trip even for an adult, but as a kid you go, God, that's going to take like 10 years to get there. And I was not keen on that. Anyway, I'm positive it was in Brisbane at a bus terminal. So we got on the bus, put all of our luggage away, find our seats, sit down. thought surely we should be leaving soon. And I kept saying to Mum, are we going soon? She said, yes, yes, we're going soon. Anyway, it didn't move. And then, you know, we saw people coming up to the bus, and my thought was, oh, there's people still getting on. And these two men walked up, and they, I wouldn't say suits, but they were dressed up-ish. And they're walking towards us, and I thought, oh, nothing of it, really. And then they stopped with us and, you know, asked Mum her name, and she said yes. And in the middle of the bus, you're under arrest. And I had no idea what was going on. So I didn't understand. And they're like, you have to get off the bus now. So, you know, everybody, just a bus full of people, just watched my mother get arrested and me following and getting put into a police car.
Oh, no.
So, yeah. And I had no idea what was going on. Anyway, we go to the police station. She's interviewed. And then she was bailed, and we had to stay in a refuge. I can't remember how long it was, but she was bailed, had to stay at this women's refuge until her court hearing. And then, so it's just me and her, and she has to go to court. And I just had to sit in the waiting room of the court while she's in the courtroom before the judge, charges read. And obviously she was let go, but I don't know the ins and outs of that part. All I know is we were free to go. So off to Melbourne we go, and we end up at a motel and then having to walk. I don't know if you know the area, but Ringwood to Croydon in the pouring rain, and, you know, my tiny little legs, that was just hell. And then, I don't know, my mom and my auntie had this big blue, and my auntie was like, you cannot seriously be walking around at this time of night with your daughter in the rain. It's disgraceful, bloody, bloody, blah. So we end up at her house, and, you know, the other aunties get involved, and it's a big family affair. And then all of a sudden my dad's in the driveway, and that was super exciting. And I don't know, we ended up, I don't even know what happened. I think I went and stayed with dad and my grandparents for a few days or whatever, and then I ended up back with her and living in a commission house, I think, in Burwood East. It was just constant moving around. There was no stability whatsoever.
Elisa, can I ask what was your mum arrested for? There's a couple of things. Number one is, what was your mum arrested for on the bus? And you said two things there. You said she had some previous indiscretions and that mum was up to her old tricks.
Her crime of choice was fraud and theft by deception. Mm-hmm. So bouncing checks, you know, back in the days when checkbooks were a big thing. If you could pay for it with check, believe me, she did. So she would basically write a lifestyle for herself and live on it until she was caught out. Yeah, it was, you know, everything that we had was basically paid for by check. It's the in-family joke with my dad and I now. You know, you want to win lotto, why not? Why bother? Just ring your mother, bounce some checks. I mean, if you don't laugh, you'll cry. So now you just got to make a big joke of it. But that's what she did. She just ripped people off. And it was going on, obviously, for quite some time. Longer than I ever imagined. I don't know when it started. I don't know how much of my very, very younger years were, you know, fraudulent, I suppose. And I don't really care, to be honest. But the fact of the matter is, for me, it happened. And And you could ask her, but you'll never get an honest answer. She doesn't have an honest bone in her body, couldn't lie straight in bed.
So with all these involvements that you had with police as a child, what were your thoughts about police? Were they good? Were they bad? Were they a bit of both?
It's funny because you would assume that I would be very anti-police. And I have no idea how I managed to separate the two, but I never looked at the police force as bad, but I did look at the police officers in certain situations as mean and grumpy. But I never was anti-police. I never thought it was the police force's fault. I never acted out against them. I don't know how a kid of that age can be objective, but somehow I was. So if a police officer was grumpy and whatever towards me, I was grumpy with them. But if they were nice to me, they were my best friend. So, and I am very pro-police, very pro-police.
Yeah, which is surprising, as you say, because the fact that you've seen them arrest your mum, you've been waiting in courts, waiting for your mum, like just being surrounded by police, I'm surprised that you don't look on police as being sort of like the bad guys. It's amazing. It may be an obvious answer to some, but never having experienced what you have, I'll ask it. Mm-hmm. What effect did that abandonment have on you as you got older? And the reason, well, there's two points to that. One is as you got older, like into your teen years, how did that abandonment affect you? But also when your kids got to the age when you were, traipsing around with your mum around the states, did that all come back then?
Absolutely.
Like, did you think, my God, how could you abandon a child of this age?
Yeah, really, really badly, but I internalized it. So it was something that just plays on my mind. Even now, it plays on my mind an awful lot every time I open my mouth to these kids. But I know that I'm very different. So I don't look at myself as a product of her and, oh, what if I do the same thing she did? Because I know I won't. But parenting at these ages, I do struggle with because I don't know how to do it. It's hard to explain. Am I doing the right thing? I don't know what it was like, I don't know how to do it. And I always wonder, am I doing this? Am I doing the right thing? But I figured, I tell myself all the time when those questions pop up, are they fed? Yes or no? Why are they not fed? Because they don't want to eat what I cook them, and that's tough luck because I'm not cooking 30 meals a day. So then I quickly say, that's okay. There's food on offer. And if they go hungry, that's not my problem. But they're okay. They've got a house. They're loved and they know that they are. But growing up as a teenager with all of that, I was a very angry teenager, very angry, but also very, I suppose you'd say, needy. I was very emotionally attached to the people in my world and so scared that everybody I got attached to would walk away. And it was very, very difficult and it did create a lot of issues. But I'm very grateful that there's a few people from those years that I talk to now that I'm still incredibly close to who just knew and just got it. I don't know how, but they just got it. And they stuck around, so I'm very lucky. I drank a lot as a teenager. That probably didn't help, but I thought it did.
Well, I suppose it was, and I'm not condoning it for one minute, but it was your way of coping with all those emotions, with that abandonment.
Yeah.
And, you know, just going back when you were talking about you struggle sometimes parenting your children now, and I've got to say that I think most parents would think very similarly that, and they haven't, a lot of them haven't been through what you've been through. So those feelings I imagine that you've got are a double what a parent who hasn't been through what you have been through, I think most parents that I'm aware of or that I know, they say the same thing. I don't know what I'm doing. There's no book. There's no rules.
There's none.
No, but what I think you've always got to remember is that you're doing your best to what you can, but you said a very important thing there, and I think that's something worth hanging on to, is you said that your kids are always fed. They know they're loved. They know that they have a warm home. They know they've got a bed, and that's the sort of thing that you never had. So, I can understand you feeling, I suppose the word is inadequate. You probably at times you're saying you feel inadequate.
That is the best way to, and I haven't been able to, you know, put a word to it, but that's exactly it. That is exactly right.
Yeah.
It's a struggle.
So, what do you remember most about living out of a suitcase with your mum in the motels and refuges, or anywhere else you could find a bed for that matter? What do you remember most about that? I can't imagine it.
So the one thing that really sticks out in my mind, we lived in a caravan park in Corowa, which is in New South Wales, just outside of Albury. I mean, it sounds terrible, really, it was, but I don't know. You know, I made friends with some of the other kids that were in the caravan park, so that wasn't too bad. But, again, hated the school because it wasn't my school, the one that I went to originally with all my friends. And I still had a lot of my important things. So my mum had these little crystals, little figurines, and they were from her mum. And she got them after my nana died. I had a crocheted baby blanket that my grandmother crocheted for me, and I had this teddy that I'd had since I was born. They are gone because we had to leave the caravan park in such a hurry. They're gone. I don't have those anymore. You know, things that were my nana's, I'll never get back. The blanket, I'll never get back. The teddy, I'll never get back. And they're little things, but at the same time, they're sentimental. And, you know, I don't have that stuff because life on the run was more important for her because she just couldn't get her shit together.
Can you tell us about the time that you found out your mum had told her new husband that you were dead?
Oh, my God. Worst night. So life was quite normal. I was living with her sister, so my maternal auntie, and we were all just in the lounge room watching a movie. I was living with my auntie, my uncle, and my two cousins, and we were watching a movie, and the phone rang, and it's my dad, and I had a chat to him, and as usual, all the normal stuff that we talk about. And he's like, all right, well, got to go. I'm at work. And he often rang me from work. So we said our goodbyes. That was fine. And then so we're all just minding our own business. Phone rings again. My auntie goes and she gets and she's in the kitchen. She's talking away. She comes into the lounge room and says, oh, Alicia, your dad's on the phone again. And I thought, it's odd. I just spoke to you. But anyway, I thought, oh, something must be wrong. And I go in and I said, what's wrong? I just spoke to you. He said, are you sitting down? And I said, yeah. Why? What's wrong? He said, so I just had a very interesting phone call. And at the time I thought, that's That's great. Congratulations. Why does this matter to me? Like, I'm happy for you, Dad. I'm happy for you. I said, okay, what? He said, so your mother's husband has just called. And I'm like, oh, God. Okay. He said, so I don't know how this happened, but he's put two and two together and ended up working out who she was. And I said, okay. Now he's tracked me down somehow, found out where I worked, and he's called me at work. I said, okay, why? Is there something wrong with her? And he said, well, we know that there is. But no, that's not the point of the conversation. I thought, okay, fair call. He said, so he rang me to apologize for my loss. I said, what loss? I mean, she wasn't a great loss. And he laughed and told me not to be mean to my mother. She's still your mother. I said, okay. He said, I don't know how to tell you this, but he was apologizing for the loss of you. And I still didn't get it. And I'm like, what are you talking about? Elisa, she told him you were dead. And I said, what? He goes, she told him that you were dead, that you and I, that her and I lost you. You died when you were 4 or 6 or something, I can't remember. Apparently you died when you were very young and a whole bunch of other crap. And I can't remember what the other crap was because I'm still trying to focus on the fact that my mother tells people I'm dead. And I'm like, what did you say? He said, oh, did she? Who was I talking to 10 minutes ago? That's a bit creepy. But so they had a chat and he said, I'm so sorry. And I said, well, you're not the one that said it, so you have nothing to apologize for. And he said, but this is not the conversation that I ever wanted to have with you. And obviously my auntie knew because he told her first. And there was no reason. Oh, hang on. No, there was. That's right. Because my dad said, well, if she's dead, how did she die? And apparently I was a childhood asthmatic, just to put into context. Apparently I died from asthma and obesity. And I was like, wow. I'm a 14-year-old girl struggling with body image issues and apparently I'm dead from obesity. That's fantastic. So I got off the phone and my auntie just looked at me. She's like, I just don't even know what to say. I'm just so sorry.
What would you say?
Yeah, I mean, and there's nothing that you can say. There's nothing that fixes that. Nothing takes it away. But after you fast forward a few years when I moved out and I was really angry and I always had her phone number with me and I don't know why, I think it was just in case, but I ended up ringing her and we came to blows about it and she told me, so she was living in Beechworth at the time and she told me that a police officer from Beechworth advised her to tell people I was dead to make it easier on her. To accept that she couldn't see me. And I was absolutely horrified. And still after that, I still didn't have a negative opinion of policing because I thought that's not right. And I later found out years down the track that I ended up in contact with Beechworth Police and I told the sergeant and he was ropeable. My officers would never, never instruct anybody to say that.
No, you're right. You'd also tried to ring your mum on your 16th birthday, didn't you? And that didn't.
I did.
And that didn't end up well either, did it?
No. Well, my auntie actually sort of snuck. We were going out for dinner, and my auntie snuck off to the bedroom to call her to tell her to call me for my birthday. You know, it's your daughter's 16th birthday, you know. Do the right thing. And anyway, she comes out of the bedroom and she said, look, Elisa, I just spoke to your mum she doesn't want to talk to you. And for some reason, I can't even remember the rest of it, but I ended up calling her and her husband answered and was just so disgusting and horrible to me. Like, he was such a pig. And then, oh, your mother doesn't want to talk to you. She's got a migraine and blah, blah, blah. She doesn't want to talk to you. And I thought, well, I don't really care. It's my 16th birthday. She has nothing to do with me any other time. She can at least say happy birthday to me. It's not hard. Anyway, she gets on the phone and, you know, it's woe is me and, you know, I'm the bitch and she's the victim. You know, it's very typical stuff. And at 16, I just thought, Jesus, you are hard work. Like, you're so exhausting. And
she called you a bitch. She called you a bitch. Yeah.
She called me a bitch and I thought, nah, I was just done trying.
God, and you did try, Elisa, didn't you? Like, you tried and
tried. Very
even,
hard.
And yeah. Even as cruel and as
Who forgives somebody after, you know, they say you're dead?
Yeah, you did.
Apparently. I mean...
But you, at least Jesus. You tried, you know. And then as a 17-year-old, you said that you tried again to contact your mum. And what happened that time?
So I actually did speak to her a little bit and, you know, I was having boy troubles at the time. And her first advice to me, because, you know, I'm 17 years old having boy dramas, and instead of going, you know, Elisa, you're better than this. You know, there's plenty of fish in the sea, the typical crap that I'd tell my kids or someone else. It was telling me to start spreading rumours around about the new girlfriend and I'm like, this is so counterproductive. Fine, I'll ring Dad. He'll be normal. And then, you know, at a party one night, friends of mine had gotten hold of my phone, which wasn't a it was nothing unusual because everybody just grabbed each other's phones and would text each other and always funny stuff. And I heard a person, and they'll forever remain nameless even though we don't speak, talking on my phone, and I thought, that's odd. But I just left it, thought nothing of it. Oh, God, like days, maybe a week later, I'm at the house and with my friends and at my best friend's house, and I get these phone calls from my auntie, who I didn't get along with anymore at the time. She hated my guts and probably still does to this day, saying the police are after you. And I thought, that's odd, I've done nothing wrong. And I said, okay, I'll deal with it. I go back to my grandmother's, and because I was living with her at the time. And I walk in the door and she says to me, Elisa, the police came here looking for you. And I just looked at her like, I did nothing wrong. And she's like, I'm not angry at you. I'm just telling you. You've got to go down there. So I'm like, oh, God, fine. So I walk down to Hillsville Police Station. Hello, how are you? You're looking for me? And the police officer at the time, very tough, was yes. And are you, you know, read out my full name, and I'm like, God, nobody's called me that for years. I must be in trouble. And then he said, we're serving an intervention order against you. And I'm like, oh, my God, what did I do? And he said, do you know this person? And I just deadpanned him straight in the eyes. I said, is this a joke? And he goes, no, who's this? Do you know the person? I said, that's my mother. He goes, you're what? And another police officer had come out and goes, I'm sorry, what was that? And I said, yeah, my mother. And then he read through all the things that she thinks that I did wrong. Was this true? Was this true? And I said, no. I said, if it was, I'd tell you. I'm fine with that. And by this stage, I was furious. And I said, no, that's not what happened. This is what happened. And he goes, look, I have to give this to you. I said, yeah, that's fine. You're just doing your job. That's fine. And he's reading out all the clauses in it. And I probably should have taken it more seriously, but he's like, you can't do this, you can't do this, you can't go within 500 metres of her. And I'm like, well, she lives in Beechworth and I'm 17 and don't have a licence. I'm not sure how that's going to work. And he laughed and he said, good point. And then he said, if you have a gun licence, you've got to hand it in and you can't have a gun licence for X amount of time. And I was like, oh, shit, I'm booked in for that. Great. And he just laughed and I'm like, this means – I take it seriously and I understand this is your job, but this means nothing to me. And he said, look, I probably shouldn't say this, but you can pretty much take that home and wipe your ass with it because really that's all that it means. And I said, well, I won't, but thank you. So I had to sign it and do all the formalities. And anyway, that's when the Beechworth police officer got in contact with me, who read my surname and went, oh, are you related to? And I said, yes, that's my dad. And he goes, oh, shit, how's he going? What's he doing? Where is he? How's the weather where you are? Are you looking after yourself? And he actually went to court in to bat for me. He said, I'm disgusted. I'm absolutely disgusted for you.
It's hard to imagine that a mother, oh, well, I just can't get my head around it. Number one is that, or what your mum's done, but what you say she's done, but also the fact that you're continually, well, not continually, but you're trying to make some contact with your mum. She's called you a bitch. She's taken out an intervention order. But the only thing I do have a problem there with is when the policeman said to you, you said, what am I going to do with this, with the intervention order? And he said, you can, pardon me, wipe your ass with it because that's all it's worth. I have to disagree with him there because I know a lot of people feel that and they say it's only a piece of paper. But that piece of paper actually gives police a power of arrest. Mm-hmm. So, I think a lot of people say that and It is only a piece of paper, but that piece of paper is very powerful in a lot of ways, and I don't like that attitude that it's only a piece of paper because it isn't. It actually it can bring people to court and have them have to answer as to why they have breached a certain condition of an intervention order. If you didn't have that intervention order, You don't have that power to get somebody to court and to have to answer to a magistrate and maybe even go inside for breaching intervention orders.
Which, you know, brings me – I agree with everything that you said and I think the attitude at the time – I mean, I know why he said it because he could see that I was being genuine.
Yep.
But that attitude too, I agree with. But a lot of people in society have that attitude. It's just a piece of paper and it'll do nothing because so often you see, you know, people have DVOs, they have intervention orders, they have all of these things and you're not dead yet, so unfortunately we can't act on it. And it's very hard. It's very hard for people to go and do these things because they go, why? It's just a piece of paper. Nobody's going to help me anyway. I mean, that helped me too, getting that intervention order, because it protected me as well. And it was what I needed.
But it also alerts the situation to the police database, because if nobody applied for any intervention orders, we wouldn't know. I can't help but think it's been how many years now? 6 years or something.
You can take the girl out of the force, but you can never take the force out of the girl.
I love it. At least applying for an intervention order, either party, at least it's on the police records that there is an issue.
There's a problem. Yeah, exactly.
Correct. Yeah. So, Elisa, with all these issues that you've had in your life, how have you managed to work your way through all this trauma and sadness and feelings of abandonment to where you are today? How have you got to today?
An absolute phenomenal amount of counselling. I've had counsellors, social workers, welfare coordinators at school, psychologists, child psychiatrists, you name it, I've had it. And it's just as well having the right people around me. I mean, now I have the best group of people around me. And I think that really does help. And now, like I remember it at school, I had a girl who told me she couldn't be friends with me because my mum had been in jail. That really pissed me off. But now I'm an open book. Like, I'll talk to anybody about it. I don't care. It doesn't make me cry anymore. But having all the people around me that I do have who understand it, who know my story and will remind me in my worst moments, you are not her. You are not like her. She's not going to upset you. She's not going to hurt you. I haven't come out unscathed. I do have anxiety, depression, PTSD. I have all those fun things, but I just deal with it. I get up every day and think, well, I have to do this. I have to keep going.
I think one of the main lessons that we can all take out of what you've just said, and having suffered PTSD myself, I know exactly what you mean. But what we can take out of that is that you've had professional intervention, whether it be a little or a lot. Professional intervention is the way to at least try and manage or to get ahead with your or get on with your life and not be full of negativity, which you would be justified in feeling, mind you. But I think the fact that you're saying you wear your heart on your sleeve, you share your
vulnerability. I do. I'm such a sook.
Yeah, well.
I'm such a sook.
But there's nothing wrong with that either. But also the fact that you share your vulnerabilities and you have surrounded yourself clearly by really supportive, strong, positive people, because I've always said that surrounding yourself by negativity is like a cancer.
It is.
So, and it eats away at you. So what you've been able to do is turn yourself around to look on the positive side, because you have been able to do that through professional intervention. And I think that's one of the main messages that I want to get out there, or you and I want to get out there, is
exactly
that you can't do everything on your own. You need some professional intervention, and there is nothing wrong with getting professional intervention and putting your hand
Absolutely.
Up to say, I am not coping. Because if you didn't get professional intervention, Elisa, I hate to think where you'd be. You'd probably be very bitter and very twisted, and you wouldn't be where you are now.
To be honest, 100% honest with you, if my auntie, my paternal auntie, did not stop me from going, or my mum from picking me up the day that she did, I have no doubt in my mind I would either be dead or a massive drug addict, because that is the path that she was walking down and the people that she was associating with. So I have no doubt in my mind. And so out of everyone in my entire situation, that woman, my auntie, she's it. She did this. She is the reason that my life has turned out the way that it has, because she put a stop to it. She wouldn't allow it. And I can't thank her enough. Like, every time I see her, I love her. I just love that woman to death. And I tell her all the time, whenever I can, that I love her. And we're close, and it's my dad's side of the family and I are very, very close. So, but as far as professional intervention is concerned, I hate the stigma that surrounds mental health and getting help. And I mean, it's exhausting, and why carry it if you don't have to? But a lot of people too, they go, "Oh, I went to a counsellor once, and you know, I didn't, I did, just didn't work for me because you haven't found the right one. It is like a pair of shoes. You have to find the one that fits.
Absolutely. That is so true.
So everybody has a personality and you just have to find one that gels with you. And once you do, it is so, it's natural, it's organic, it just all comes out and that person just knows, picks up on you and knows exactly what you need and it helps. Every couple of years, I find a new psychologist. Yeah, I find a psychologist, not necessarily a new one, but I'll be good for a few years and then I feel myself getting into a slump and I call my doctor and I book a long appointment for a mental health care plan. And I go in and I see her and she's like, "What's wrong?" And I say to her, "I've lost my mind, I'm a bit of a basket case, can't have a referral." And she laughs and she says, "Of course you can." So we go through the questionnaire that you have to do and she'll be like, "This isn't okay. Absolutely. Here's your care plan. You know what you need to do." And then I go and have my 10 sessions and I'm great for a few years or what. It might be a year, it might be 6 months, whatever. It might be 5 years. And I just stay on top of it.
You know what that's called, Alisa? What that is called is maintenance. And why is it that we can go back to, I don't know, Weight Watchers or all these different things for maintenance, but what is it about mental health that we feel like we're ashamed, we don't want to admit it, that we are actually, going to the doctor and just getting a top-up? It's just such a stigma. And the more we talk about it, the more people might get to understand that it's just normal to feel stressed, and there's nothing wrong with it.
Exactly right. I mean, you don't drive your car for 50,000 Ks and go, "Nah, it doesn't need a service, she'll be right." You go and get it serviced so it keeps driving the way that you want it to continue to drive. And I don't think that mentally anybody, a person should be any different. And you don't have to go to a counsellor or a psychologist. You find something that fits for you. But I can't speak highly enough of psychology. I think it's such an amazing thing that we have at our fingertips.
Likewise.
But everyone finds their thing.
Yep. Two more questions and then we'd better finish up and let you go and put your head on a pillow for half an hour. Oh, you've done very well, Alisa.
I really have.
You've obviously had lots of water. When was the last time you spoke to your mum?
That would have been 2003 and I have not seen her face since November 98.
I just cannot. Do you know if she's still with us?
Weird, isn't it?
Yeah.
No idea. I don't know if she's dead or alive, but I do have this habit that every so often I think I should probably check and see if I can find that out. I don't know, moral obligation, I guess, blood thicker, water, whatever. And every so often I get this urge and I ring Dame Phyllis Frost Centre. That's the last place that I know that she was imprisoned at. And the last time that I rang, I said to the receptionist, "Look, this is going to be a very odd request for you." And I explained my story and I'm like, "Is she remanded with you?" And the last lady I spoke to, she was so beautiful. She was so funny.
Yeah.
She goes, "Oh, darling, it's okay. No, she doesn't live here at the moment." And I said, "Oh, good. Okay." She goes, "That's not to say she's not somewhere else, but she doesn't live here right now. She's not one of our residents." I said, "Okay." And then she goes, "Oh, hang on. Was this a name that she went by as well?" And my heart sunk. And I thought, she's there. And I live 40 minutes from there. And when I'm at work, I can throw a rock and hit the fence almost. And I thought, "Oh, God, oh, God, oh, God." And I said, "Yeah, that is her." She goes, "Yeah, nah, don't stress. She doesn't live here." And I thought, "You bitch. You just had my heart in my throat." And I laughed and I said, "All right, well, thanks. Good to know." She goes, "Talk to you in a few years." Hey, yeah. So she thinks it's normal, so that's all right.
Oh, God. Alisa, what would you say to young adults, maybe possibly teenagers out there who are trying to deal with similar situations that you've experienced, similar emotions, feelings, all that? What would you say to them?
Firstly, I would really encourage the professional intervention. There's no shame in it. It's not, doesn't make you less of a person. It actually, it helps so much and it keeps you on the right path. You've got paths to choose from. You can go down the wrong path and make a complete mess of everything, or you can, you know, pick yourself up, dust yourself off, and just achieve the things that you want to achieve. You have nothing to prove to, and I certainly don't. I have nothing to prove to anybody else, and that took a very, very long time of hard work, because I really did for many, many years think I have to prove to everybody that I'm not my mum, but I don't. It's you've only got yourself to answer to. You've only got yourself to prove things to. If you want to be a brain surgeon, you're the only person that you have, that you owe anything to. It's very important to remember that you're important and there's always help out there. You can't do it alone. You just can't. You can't just, go through life and think, she'll be right. She'll be right, because she won't always be right. Everybody's cup overflows.
Well, Alisa, all I can say is thank you so much for sharing such a personal story. And I know it's a story that will resonate with too many out there, but it will also give them hope that life does get better. And
it does.
You are living proof of that. So thank you again. And you go to bed early tonight. No more dancing, no more drinking, and no more late nights, okay?
I can't. I can't back it up anymore. Too old for that. And I've got to host a baby shower tomorrow, so I've actually got to be a grown-up. God.
I hope you're all having water and maybe some cordial tomorrow, but not red. Not red cordial.
There'll be tea. There'll be tea, because Mum likes tea. So we all like tea. And yes, there'll be no alcohol. I won't rub her nose in it, and I just can't do it.
Well, look, you have a good day. Thank you again for
thank you for having me.
Oh, thank you. It's been an absolute pleasure, and all strength to you, Alisa, for where you are now to what you've been through. So thanks again.
Thank you so much. I do appreciate you taking the time to listen.
I know you do. Thank you. Hey, it's Narelle here again. Thanks for listening, and I hope you enjoy the podcasts as much as we enjoy putting them together. But to make sure you never miss an episode of Narelle Fraser Interviews, hit subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to leave a rating and even a review. And please share it with all your friends too. And again, thanks for joining us. We have got some amazing stories to tell. So thanks again. See ya.